welcome to the Well Mind with Dr. Mike show. We're very fortunate today to have Sherry Gaba with us. Sherry Gaba, I believe. Is that how you say it, Sherry?
Yes. Uh-huh.
Sherry Gaba. And Sherry is an expert in relationships and in recovery from addiction. And has written a couple of wonderful books. One is called The Marriage and Relationship Junkie, Kicking Your Obsession. And another really wonderful book called The Law of Sobriety, Attracting Positive Energy for a Powerful Recovery. Sherry is also a very talented editor of an online recovery magazine on all things recovery from addiction called Recovery Today. And Sherry, what is your website where people can reach you?
I will give them. I'll give you two. One is my regular website, which is Sherry Gaba. That's where I have all my blogs and programs and my bio, just everything about me. And there's just so much on that website. That's Sherry, SHERRYGABA.com. And then my latest passion is my group coaching program, and people can go to wakeuprecovery.com. That's wake
spell that up. For people.
Oh, wake up, W-A-K-E-U-P, wake up, recovery, R-E-C-O-V-E-R-Y, wake up, recovery.
Oh, okay, got it. Okay, great. Well, Sherry, it's so good to have you today. Our topic for today is love addiction. And I know that you've had a lot of experience in your coaching, professional and personal life, I think, with this. And can you tell us a little bit about what is love addiction?
Well, you're absolutely right. I can talk about it from a personal point of view and a professional point of view. I was married to an alcoholic, and he relapsed many times. And after a really difficult time where I got really sick, I got shingles, I started losing hair, I had a staph infection, kidney stones, all these things were happening to me, and I couldn't understand it, and I realized that I am a codependent and a love addict. I sort of knew that I was always different, just like the addict or alcoholic knows that they're different. There's something inside of them that knows that there is this emptiness, this need to fill up that emptiness. For me, for the drug addict, it's drugs or alcohol or substances. For me, it's a lifestyle addiction or a process addiction, which we call love addiction. And basically, it means becoming addicted to the mood-altering activity and behavior that creates almost the identical euphoric state to that of a mood-altering substance. So the relationship or being in love or the romance is the person's only identity. And in the case of codependency, always wanting to control, other people, persons, and places and things. So it has some of the same effects, but when a breakup occurs, an addictive lover will long for the attachment and the pleasurable feelings of that locked relationship, just like the drug user craves the drug. So it has some of the same feelings inside. And, there are many process addictions. There's food, sex, shopping, betting, gambling, internet, so many different lifestyle or process addictions. And in this case, today we're talking about love or relationship addiction. And in my case, I actually was married multiple times, and I, gained my sense of being by being connected to another person. Just like the drug addict needs, or the alcoholic needs their drugs or alcohol, I needed to be in a relationship to feel comfortable in my own skin, which, of course, set me up for settling in a lot of cases. But, what we're going to talk about, I suppose, on this interview is that there are reasons that we do what we do, and so the point of writing the book, The Marriage and Relationship Junkie, was to, help eradicate the stigma and the shame or the blame in that you've had many relationships that haven't worked out, or you've been married many times, or your picker is off. There are reasons that we do these things, and so that's really what my whole mission in life is, to just eradicate the shame around that, because I was very embarrassed by being in multiple marriages and telling people, I've been divorced several times. And it was only until I really got honest that everything really changed in my life.
And when you say getting honest, Sherry, what did that look like when you say getting honest? What does that mean for people who suffer from love addiction?
I think waking up and just accepting that I had an issue and I needed to get help for it. and that it was really causing me many health issues. And I was, you know, I had, like I said, I think my emotional or proverbial emotional bottom was when I was married to my alcoholic ex-husband who had multiple relapses, and I just spent years trying to, you know, quote, save him or whatever. Even though I worked in the field, I've been on celebrity rehab, I wrote a book about sobriety, I still had this insatiable need to fix him, and it was really because I just didn't want to have another failed relationship. And quite honestly, I didn't want to be, quote, alone. I was really scared of it not working out. And then until I got really, really sick is when I had the wake-up call that I realized, you know, there's nothing worth, you know, literally dying over. I mean, seriously, you could actually, I don't want to be, you know, so dramatic, but really I was pretty sick. And until I was able to let go and start working on the issues, I wanted to just also explain for people listening that maybe they're wondering, well, am I a love addict? Am I a codependent? So some of the signs and symptoms that people want to look for in their own lives would be, you know, overadapting to what others want, kind of losing yourself in the relationship, having really loose boundaries, having a fear of letting go. That was a big one for me. A big one for me as well was the fear of the unknown. You know, I knew that if I stayed with this person, this is what I was going to get, even though it was really awful, because he wasn't willing to do a recovery program. So there was no way that he was going to probably get sober and we were going to go back to the life we had when he was sober. So I was just, I knew what I knew, but I was afraid of what I didn't know and what would it look like if we broke up. So that was really scary for me, the fear of the unknown. And then this attempt to try to change others, you know, wanting to fix someone to be what you want them to be. You know, a big sign of relationship addiction is sort of falling for the illusion rather than the person. And in my case, you know, when I met my ex-husband, and that's not the only love addicted relationship, but I'm just using him as an example. When I met him, I knew he was a recovering alcoholic, but I really didn't understand at the time what that meant. And this was when I first was in graduate school, and I just, you know, I thought, oh, well, he lost everything. He's never going to drink or use again. And I really had no clue that he really needed to have a program in his life. So I was always, you know, trying to sort of change him and push him to do these things. And, you know, really it was his path that he needed to follow, not my path for what I thought I wanted him. So it's kind of been an illusion of who I thought he could be or would be. A big one is needing others to feel whole, you know, having that chronic emptiness inside and not feeling comfortable unless you're in relationship. Always looking for others for affirmation and worth and validation, like, you know, feeling like you're not anything unless somebody's kind of, you know, bad-a-boying you or bad-a-girling you. It's always like what other people see in you rather than what you see in yourself. Really a big one is fearing abandonment. That's a huge one for love addicts. And then having those withdrawal symptoms that we can talk about later, which are really similar to what an addict would feel without their drugs. And then giving up who you are out of the fear that you might lose someone and, you know, needing their approval to feel like you, you know, belong. So those are the things people want to look for if they're wondering, you know, do I have a love addiction issue?
Okay. Yeah, very, very, very well described. I mean, it sounds like from what you're saying that because a lot of these things are very human. I mean, a lot of us, if we're alone, we're vulnerable to feeling alone and the emptiness that can come with that. And all of us have a very human, biologically determined need to belong to a group and to receive affirmation from others. And all of us are wired to make attachments to other people. That's
yeah.
Wired into our brain. We are attaching creatures, and when we make attachments, we really are wired biologically to feel great pain when those attachments are broken.
Yeah.
And all of us have that impulse. If we see something that we don't like in somebody, there is that sort of normal impulse to want to try and maybe modify somebody else's behavior to our benefit. So I think a lot of what you're saying is very human, but what I'm wondering if the difference between sort of where you cross the line into unhealthy is where you maintain an attachment to somebody even when it causes you great harm.
Oh, right. Absolutely.
Is that sort of the way? Because I sort of think of addiction as a compulsive behavior to avoid pain now that causes much more pain in the long run.
Right. You think about, you know, the first step of Alcoholics Anonymous, which is, you know, the unmanageability of your life due to the substance. And I'm not saying exactly right, but you know what I'm saying. So it's the same unmanageability. Your life is going kind of crazy and haywire. So when
right.
I talk all of the physical ailments that I started getting, that really was unmanageability for me. And not to mention
yeah.
the obsession and the obsession to control, the obsession to heal, the obsession to make it right. It becomes very obsessive.
Now, one thing that you mentioned was, and I just wonder if you feel that some people are more vulnerable. I mean, if you pick somebody who where you can have the capacity for a healthy relationship and you don't need to change them because the relationship is basically healthy and there's the capacity for mutuality and intimacy, then there's less of that compulsion to want to change somebody. But if you get into a relationship with somebody who is impaired in terms of their capacity to have a healthy, loving relationship, is there some issue in terms of a vulnerability to maybe choosing the wrong kind of people to begin with love addiction?
Right, and that's what I was talking about earlier, about eradicating the stigma around it, because I think there are certain characteristics that make up people who choose to attach to someone that is probably not great for them. For example, I had early abandonment. I was an incubator baby. Today is actually my birthday. And when I
Today's your birthday?
Yes, today is my birthday.
Oh, happy birthday!
That's a big birthday. I'm 60 today, and it's a really wonderful birthday, actually. But 60 years ago, if a child was, if a preemie was born, and I was 2.5 months early, they actually had me stay in the incubator. My mother did not touch, bond, attach, or nurture me for the first 2.5 months of my life. They were afraid she would spread germs. So, you know, I was, by all intents and purposes, like one of those, you know, Romanian babies that are in an orphanage, so to speak. I mean, it wasn't...
You're lucky to be alive, right? Babies die without physical affection, don't
yes.
they?
Yes, very lucky to be alive. I knew I was always different and always longing and craving for attachment, but I just didn't understand why, and I couldn't understand why it was never enough. And then as I got older and I understood the trauma piece that I experienced, because that is very much a traumatic experience to be in an incubator for 2.5 months, I realized this is why I was set up to be a love addict. So, you know, if you look at other situations, like let's say you come from a family where they're divorced and you have a single parent, you're a single parent, and the parent sort of parentifies the child, makes the child feel like a little adult. That's a form of a trauma. You know, using the child as a surrogate partner, you know, really sets the child up for confusion. So they're always other focused. They're always trying to take care of somebody. It's always about everything outside of them instead of themselves.
Mm-hmm.
A neglectful parent, not getting, you know, having an inadequate, not getting your needs met, you know, having an inadequate parenting. Abandonment by a parent, abuse. And then so panic sets in, and as an adult, you know, we end up responding like an infant in pain, and then we end up clinging to others. So we're craving others to make us feel whole. So love addiction really comes from not being enough, not having enough. It's an unconscious attempt to satisfy the developmental hunger for something, to belong. So we're always looking outside ourselves to fix our fear, our pain, our abandonment issues, and any kind of discomfort that we might be feeling.
Yes, yes. So what you're saying is that trauma and neglect, including neglect, really have a huge role in terms of creating a vulnerability for addictive relationships.
Right. I mean, think about, you know, let's say you came from a family where your parents were addicts or alcoholics and they were, you know, physically and emotionally unavailable. Or even if you had really parents who were not emotionally intelligent, they just didn't know how to, you know, give affection. Or say, I love you, or, you know, of course, these are the way kids were raised, you know, at certain times, you know, that was just the norm in some cases, but, you know, it has its effects, right, and so you're always, you know, clinging, you're almost like the hungry ghost, you know, always craving that love, and you're right, it is the human condition, we all want to attach, we all want to have love in our life, and I certainly am a happier person when I'm in relationship, however, I'm not the person I was where I had to be in relationships to really be happy. I mean, after I got divorced, I spent a good 4 years, you know, really digging deep. I did some trauma work. I did what's known as somatic experiencing work with a therapist, which is a form of trauma therapy, and there's other types of therapy. There's EMDR, there's tapping, and all kinds of things that you can do to help you really embody yourself so that you can be with yourself and be comfortable. I mean, it doesn't mean you don't want to attach or have a relationship, but I think what it does is it sets you up to pick healthier partners. You're not desperate. You're not going to settle necessarily. You're going to have trust in yourself and your own internal wisdom and be able to be with yourself. But, you know, I'm certainly not saying that being in a relationship, you know, there's something wrong with you because you want to be in a relationship. I think, like you said, we all want to be, you know, we all want to be loved. We all want to be, you know, acknowledged. We want to be validated. All of that stuff is normal. It's just that when it takes on, a, you know, the unmanageability where, you know, your life is just going out of control because of it. I mean, one of the things I would love to talk about if we have time is the whole digital dating landscape that we're living in.
Oh, please, go ahead. Yeah.
Well, I think, you know, that really sets us up for love addiction because everything is based on, you know, likes, followers, you know, people, you know, are they ghosting you, which is this thing they call where the person disappears, you know, you meet them online and then they go away or go on a few dates and then they don't call you back or, you know, in the old days, you know, people had, I guess you'd say manners, you know, if you didn't like someone, you were honest, you said, look, I don't think this is a match, you know, goodbye, but nowadays people actually disappear. So that just sets the person up for abandonment every time that happens. So you've got to be really, like, careful. If you're going to date online in this digital age, be really careful that you don't take those things personally if you can. And if you know yourself, that if, you know, that every time you get rejected, you're going to fall to pieces. You know, maybe digital dating isn't really for you. I think you really need to take a hard look at how do you really want to meet someone in the world because I really think that digital dating is really like a candy store. People are just looking for bigger and better and taller and richer and smarter and blah, blah, blah. And I think that it makes it very difficult for someone who, you know, struggles with abandonment or early trauma or, you know, rejection and stuff like that.
Yeah, well put, well put. You know, I think one of the biggest paradoxes, Sherry, of being a human being is that we have to develop a capacity to be both autonomous and interdependent. And that's probably one of the most difficult things to do as a human being. And we need both. We need our autonomy. We need our ability to feel whole and apart from our relationships with others. But at the same time, we're human, and there's such a need for intimate relationships and for interdependence. And I wonder if you could talk a little bit about, as you see it, the difference between unhealthy dependence and interdependence.
So in a healthy relationship, I think when couples first meet, they idealize each other as they are forming this attachment, right?
That's normal, right?
And it's
That's
normal.
That's called falling in love, right?
Exactly. Well, I will say this, though. When it's really fast and quick, I have to say that I think you're replicating something else. Like, I think when you fall in love in that way that is so, like, over the top, I have some thoughts about that. But I think what I'm trying to say is that as love matures, I think it just becomes less intense and much more secure, and then the trust develops alongside the love. I mean, I'm not saying you shouldn't have those hormonal feelings and, you know, be attracted to that person. But I think when it's way over the top, I always say to my clients, you know, slow and steady. Like, get to know the person. Like, yes, that's very exciting. You think you're falling in love, great. But take your time because it may be some other, you know, unconscious need that this person is filling, you know, fulfilling for you. I think people with marriage and relationship addiction never get past that initial stage of falling in love. So they idealize the person they're in love with. You know, like I talked about earlier, they put that person on such a pedestal, and they don't even, like, know the person. And that's why I always say, you know, slow and steady, get to know a person. They never feel secure enough to trust them. And then they become dependent on the person they love in a very unrealistic way, hoping somehow this person's going to create a kind of happily ever after for them. And it's unrealistic to expect anyone else to create a satisfying life for you. So inevitably, you're going to be disappointed. Their relationships are ultimately never truly satisfying, yet they can't seem to live without them. So I don't think they're really based on healthy bonding, but on sort of a psychological bondage.
Right. It's as if somehow people are unconsciously depending on a relationship to fix the childhood wounds that really cannot be fixed. What was our wounds in the past can't in a present relationship, right?
Right. We have like a psychological term for that, which is repetition compulsion.
Right.
So picking the same person over and over again to fix what was not met early on, and then if you finally get this person to be who you want them to be, you will heal that childhood wound.
Right. Well, this is thank you. This is great. This is WellMind. For those who are listening, this is WellMind with Dr. Michael McGee here with our guest Sherry Gaba, talking about love addiction, and we'll return in just a few minutes. Welcome back to WellMind with Dr. Mike. This is Dr. Michael McGee here, and we are very, very fortunate today to have with us our guest, Sherry Gaba, the author of The Marriage and Relationship Junkie, and we're talking today about love addiction. Welcome back, Sherry.
Oh, thank you. Thank you again for having me.
It's great to have you. And we've been talking about the relationship between trauma and love addiction. And I'm wondering if you could share a little bit for people, reflecting on the sense of the impact of trauma on our sense of ourself and our sense of ourself in relationship with other people, and how that sets us up to be vulnerable for love addiction.
Yeah, I mean, I think the word that just keeps coming up in my head when it comes to this subject is this toxic shame, you know, this feeling of unworthiness, this feeling of being invisible. You know, if we were talking about if you were neglected or abused or, God forbid, molested, or in my case, being in an incubator and then having sort of not the most present mother anyway. These things, you know, they're scars that occur, and they're real. And I think of the idea that, you know, you feel like you're invisible, you don't count, you're not worthy, and so then you take those feelings and then you transfer that into your adult relationships, and you feel unworthy, and you become very other-focused, and that's where that codependency piece comes in. And, you know, you're almost having like an out-of-body experience because you never were embodied, because you were always feeling like you weren't important, that you were invisible. So the trauma work that I did was, you know, getting back in my body, so almost discharging all that negative energy that was inside of me. You know, when you experience trauma, like for an animal, there's a sort of like they experience the trauma and then they shake it off. So like if you ever pet your dog and then your dog kind of shakes it off, and then that's the end of that. Or you think about a duck having a fight with another duck, and then they have their fight, and then they flap their wings, and then the fight is over. But for humans, when we have trauma, you know, that trauma, if it's not resolved or dealt with, it stays in our bodies. So we have either a fight, flight, or freeze response. So you can't really fight your childhood parents. You can't really flee. So you end up sort of freezing during all these traumatic episodes. And the energy, you know, your audience wanted to think about something in their life that was traumatic, whether it be a childhood experience or maybe it is something like tsunami, earthquake, war veterans, fire, you know, maybe it's that type of trauma. But if it's a childhood trauma, just kind of notice in your body where do you feel it. And then the way to really discharge it is to be the, you know, observer of that trauma. So it's sort of this mindfulness of, you know, being curious about where the trauma is in your body and just allowing it to be there without having to do anything about it. Because really what addiction is, whatever the addiction is you're constantly running from yourself. That's what self-medicating is. You don't want to be inside yourself. You're not comfortable in your own skin. You have what we call a dis-ease. And so once you are comfortable within yourself, and I mean really comfortable in your body, which can happen with different trauma therapies that are out there and available, then you don't need to run outside yourself to feel worthy or to feel whole. You will no longer feel empty because you'll be okay with you. And I think that's really important. I mean, if the trauma piece is not resolved, you're always going to be looking outside yourself or to feel good on the inside. And, you know,
very well put.
I'd be saying the program, it's an inside job. What?
It's an inside job. So you mentioned you know, some somatic therapy that you've done and some EMDR type work. What are the other components? What does recovery look like for somebody who suffers from a love addiction?
Well, I think, you know, there's different things you can do. I mean, if you have early trauma, I highly, highly recommend, you know, going and getting therapy with a really good therapist that deals with trauma. I do somatic experiencing with my clients. That's what I do with my therapist, and so it's been just invaluable. But just being on the call right now, I think, is really like the first step. There's this awareness. There's this consciousness like, oh, there's an issue here. I get it. I do these things. And so kind of getting out of that denial, like you're aware. And so this is the first step, just being conscious. And then making a decision to change. And then, again, like I keep saying over and over again, learning to stop looking for external solutions for problems that you have the answers within. Exploring all these fears that keep you stuck and making the same choices over and over again. What are those fears? And just really breaking them down. You know, moving out of the denial, examining those early suppressed trauma that occurred if it occurred in your childhood. Self-parenting, I mean, really loving that little inner child within you, you know, kind of opening up the palm of your hand and kind of looking at that little Mike or little Sherry and just really loving that inner child. Becoming a loving, forgiving, and compassionate person to yourself. Some of the things that you might give to someone else, start giving to yourself. And that can also include even as simple as self-care. You know, use the pain to grow and prepare for a healthy relationship. Learn to trust yourself. Learn to know when it's time to let go. And then, again, getting a really good therapist and maybe attending Sex and Love Addict Anonymous meetings or Codependent Anonymous meetings, or some cases it could be Al-Anon, but, you know, finding a really great 12-step program. I think these are the best solutions for recovery from love addiction.
Well, you really covered the whole gamut there, and I really appreciate your noting. You also mentioned the issue of mindfulness and self-compassion, to be mindfully aware of one's pain and to not run from one's pain.
Right.
And try and numb it through validation or love from others, but to really self-compassionately hold and our pain and show ourselves compassion.
Yeah, I mean, even right, listeners wanted to put even their hands over their heart and just, you know, imagine a really soft heart, imagining giving yourself that love and compassion, you know, being the higher self or be the parent of that little child inside of you that needed that love and that validation, knowing that it can come from you.
Yes, exactly. One exercise that I have done with patients that you may be familiar with is to imagine a time to get very still in meditation, get very still, get very present with one's breath, for example, get very, very present, let thinking die down, and then bring up an image where you did feel loved or cared for or somebody was kind to you, and really take in the loving feeling that you experienced. I think one of the paradoxes of recovering from love addiction is that we have to renounce using other people in an addictive way to attend to our trauma and our pain. But at the same time, there's a very healthy need for the love of support of others in the healing process, because I don't think anybody does recovery alone, and nobody heals alone. So in a way, we do need a certain kind of relationships to help us to heal from our relationship addiction, wouldn't you say?
That we do need healthy relations, is that what you're asking?
Yes. Ironically, we do need healthy relationships with others to help us to heal.
Right. Right.
From relationship addiction.
Yeah, I would say for me it was joining a 12-step program and having a group of women that, you know, kind of held me up while I just could not, you know, hold myself up. It was very helpful. The connection and the camaraderie and the love. I mean, they all attended my dad's funeral. They all took me out to eat this week for my 60th birthday. So, yes, human connection, as long as you're getting it in a healthy way, is very, very important. And as far as that meditation, oh, you probably have to
take a break right now.
Yeah, we'll take a break here. This is Well Mind with Dr. Mike, Dr. Michael McGee here with our guest, Sherry Gaba, talking about love addiction, and we'll be back in just 1 minute. Welcome back to Well Mind with Dr. Mike, Dr. Michael McGee here with our guest, Sherry Gaba, talking about love addiction. Welcome back, Sherry.
Thank you. Thank you. You know, I was thinking about what you were saying about meditating on a time in your life where you felt loved. And the one thing I just would say is that sometimes, there are, you know, you don't have any childhood experiences of being loved. So I think, you know, I would be careful with that one. I think it's a great idea in theory. But I think at least my experience has been when I've tried to do things like that, and if someone never had any childhood memories that were positive, it sort of brings up even more pain, you know? So for me, in my case, if someone asked me to think of a memory, what I would think about is that I'm a grandmother now. I have a 3-year-old granddaughter. And so I just think about the love and the presence and the connection that I have with her. That is my base of love, you know? So for someone else, it could be something else. Could be a teacher, a mentor, or maybe it was a grandparent, maybe it was a neighbor, maybe, you know, but just to make sure that people understand, you know, not to feel like, oh, but I don't have any, like, childhood parental loving memories, you know.
Right. It may not be childhood, and it might even be adulthood. And I think for some of my patients, where they have felt the most love was maybe in a therapist's office with somebody, a therapist who cared for them.
Yeah, I agree.
And that brings us to the issue of I think that none of us recovers alone. And ironically, to recover from relationship addiction, we do need relationships to do that, and we need to figure out some way to develop healthy relationships where we can borrow the love of others until we develop the capacity for our own self-compassion.
Right. So that you're not clinging to negative relationships for that love, absolutely, 100%. I mean, a lot of times the opposite end of love addiction is love avoidance, and that is a form of love addiction, by the way.
Right.
Someone has, you know, intimacy issues, and they keep avoiding relationships, or as soon as they get too close, they get afraid. You know, that's a big issue for love addicts, is that they pick unavailable partners. And, you know, I remember I used to say, oh, you know, this guy and this guy, they were all unavailable. They were not emotionally available, blah, blah, blah. And then I realized one day, you know what? I wasn't available to me. I was not intimate with myself. So how could I possibly be, you know, intimate with anybody else? So it wasn't really just about them being unavailable. I was unavailable. So it's really important to really take ownership of your place in the relationship, and not just, you know, point the finger at the other person.
Absolutely. Yeah, Melanie Klein talks about one of the three sort of ego-based or fear-based ways of relating to others is to take sort of an anti-dependent, pseudo-autonomous stance of saying that you don't need anybody and avoiding the riches of mutuality and intimacy altogether. Because of maybe not having learned how to be mutual, or because an experience of mutuality, intimacy growing up was so very painful that it's just something that they avoid completely, and then that leads to sexual anorexia. And
then there could also be, let's say you grew up with a very, a parent that was just very enmeshed, you know, overly, I don't know, I'm trying to think of the word, is the word when a parent is just, you know, too enmeshed.
I think enmeshed is the perfect word, where they're just completely melded in terms of their identity and their issues and their lives with the child.
That could create that love avoidant personality, because
sometimes
you get closer, like, oh my God, you actually can be like repelled when you grow up like that, but, you know, or you can get repelled if you didn't get the love, because then when you're getting this attention, it's unfamiliar. I mean, you know, finally you've met somebody healthy, and they're available, and you're working on yourself, and you're trying to be available, and then they're coming towards you, and you're like, oh, I don't know, but, you know, just take your time, you know, take your time, because if you're with the person that's right for you, I think they're going to understand you know, you're, you know, this sort of thing. Plus, you'll be working on yourself, and you just kind of come together. Does that make sense?
Absolutely. Yeah, I think you know, there's a great book by Lannan and Amiri called A General Theory of Love. Have you heard of that book?
I haven't.
It's a wonderful book, and it basically talks about the evolution of the capacity to love and be loved as a mammalian function that's an evolution of the emotional relational part of the brain, which is called the limbic system of the brain that mammals have. And it really is something which is neurologically elaborated over years of early development. And if that process of developing that capacity is damaged by trauma or neglect, then people literally need to learn how to love in a healthy way.
It's basically rewiring the brain. I mean, I'm thinking of both
exactly.
Where they'll say, you know, we're going to love you till you love yourself. I mean, literally,
right.
that's the truth, because they probably never felt loved. And part of not feeling loved was maybe part of the reason why they self-medicated. And, you know, it's really interesting, the whole thing. I'm thinking about the 12 steps as we talk, because it really is a place, you know, all of the wisdom in those rooms, you know, often are what we're talking about here, where you can receive many of the things that we're talking about.
Exactly, yeah. A 12-step fellowship is such a great opportunity. One has to be very careful in terms of who you associate with. But there
yeah.
are a lot of very loving, healthy people that are available.
Yeah, absolutely.
You
have to use discernment.
You know, in terms of recovery from love addiction and developing a capacity to love in a healthy way, the other thing that comes to mind that I would just mention is long-term process group therapy can be incredibly important in healing for learning to love.
I think that's a great example of sort of like being in the group and it being a microcosm of what you could experience outside of the group. Unfortunately, there just aren't a lot of group therapy out there. I mean, it's very difficult to find. Maybe where you are, there's more of those programs, but it's not easy to find. But it is. It's an excellent clinical atmosphere to create what you need outside of that group. You know, giving
yeah.
all of the
yeah.
confidence and the security and the trust. It's a great idea, for sure.
It is. Yes. Well, this is great. Can we turn a little bit to a little bit different topic? I'm wondering, Sherry, what does withdrawal from love addiction look like?
So it's agonizing. You know, you feel empty, obsessive, you feel panic, a sense of not knowing who you are, this feeling you'll never find love again. But for the positive side is, at this point, you then have the opportunity to become whole again. So withdrawing is a time to meet yourself, get intimate with yourself, find the authentic, precious self that you've been avoiding, really. So it's a time for self-love and healing and healthier relationships.
So really, if people can embrace their pain and understand that the withdrawal is a normal reaction, and that on the other side of that distress is something much better that can help
exactly.
them to sustain
it's
that
just
process.
The point that we place the person is to experience the pain so that you can get to the other side of the pain, for sure.
Exactly. Well, this is great. Again, this is Well Mind with Dr. Mike. Dr. Michael McGee here with our expert guest, Sherry Gava, talking about love addiction. And we will return in just a minute to conclude our show. Welcome back to the Well Mind with Dr. Mike show with Dr. Michael McGee here. Our guest today is Sherry Gava, and we're talking about love addiction. Before the break, we were talking about the importance of other people and of group therapy sometimes, if that's available, for learning how to safely love and be loved and see and be seen, and to learn to be intimate in a healthy way. While experiencing one's own wholeness in relationship. And one thing that we touched on briefly that it'd be great to return back to, Sherry, is 12-step program and other mutual help groups and maybe even church community groups and other group forums where people can learn to be in relationship and experience their wholeness
yeah,
in the context of others.
I think it's really important. You know, I'm thinking of, you know, why I created my program, Wake Up Recovery. It's an online community where people, you know, I do a live call once a month, and people can share privately on Facebook in the private community, and they get, you know, all kinds of lessons and things they can share with each other. And it's another format because, you know, we're living in such a, you know, we're living in an online world. And so sometimes people can't even get to meetings. If they can get to meetings, it's an excellent source of support, like we've been talking about. But I'm so amazed, like, of all the other online or other programs out there to get support. You know, there's yoga and recovery, Buddhism and recovery. You know, my program, Wake Up Recovery, there's so many, you know, there's just so many options out there for people. They just have to Google recovery. And there's so many young people, you know, forming all kinds of things. There's different types of 12-step programs. There's programs where, you know, you believe in God or you don't believe in God. Like, there's smart recovery. There's, I'm trying to think of some of the other programs that are out there. I mean, it's just endless, you know, and there's something for everybody. There's even programs, you know, where you do meetings online. So, you know, if someone's listening out there, you know, find your tribe, find your community. You know, maybe it is a church group. A lot of churches even have 12-step meetings at their church. They hold 12-step meetings at their churches. You know, find your peeps, because it's a beautiful way to receive, to learn how to receive. Because I think that's part of the issue, too, with love addiction, is that you don't know how to receive. You don't know how to receive because you never did receive what you needed. And so it's very foreign for you when you do receive. And to be in a healthy relationship, you have to give and you have to receive. So I think you've made an excellent point of that groups can be a great, you know, like I said earlier, a microcosm for healing.
Yeah, so in addition to individual therapy and mindfulness and self-compassion, the essential role of community in helping us to heal from trauma, how important community is.
Yeah, I would agree. Are you asking a question or just me?
Oh, just sort of underscoring the point of finding community. I think the other thing for many people who have suffered trauma and have suffered from love addiction is ironically, there's this unconscious way that people can sort of fend off and, as you said, not receive really healthy love that's made available to them, that there's an unconscious and reflective way that people shut that out and don't receive an abundance of love that may be there all the time.
They don't trust, or if they're starting to, yeah, another issue is they tend to sabotage. I think of my own ex who had just a horrible childhood and had severe trauma and never really dealt with it, and he just kept, he had so much loss in his life, and a lot of it he created of his own making because he never worked on that early trauma piece. So he would have these wonderful relationships with wonderfully loving, you know, women, and then he would just, you know, kind of relapse. And it wasn't just, I think, the alcohol. I think it was just a sabotaging of something that was good. He just couldn't receive it. It just felt unbearable. It was just, it almost repelled, you know, that's what it does. It actually repels you because it's so foreign. You know, we usually go for what we know. I mean, we pick people, we pick situations that are familiar. And when something's unfamiliar, you know, we usually run away from it. And so sometimes I say if something is feeling kind of unfamiliar, maybe you need to kind of take a look at that and go, maybe this is actually a healthy situation for you.
Right. You know, Sherry, you're making such a good point, which is, and the way I say this to my patients is that people will do what is familiar to them rather than what is good for them every time.
Yeah, I think we have a default system inside of us. And so when we're on the edge of something really great, when we're on the edge of, you know, this could even be a career, this could be a relationship, this could be pretty much anything. When we're on the edge of something amazing, often we will backpedal because it's so scary. We'd rather live in the known than the unknown. And really, you know, as Deepak Chopra says, all possibilities exist in the unknown. You know, infinite possibilities exist when you don't know. It's what we, you know, and that's really, I think, really key, is not to be afraid of the unknown.
Yeah, and I guess to really make it get very, very clear with the help of others on what is good for you and to anticipate and know that doing what is good for you is going to feel uncomfortable because it's unfamiliar. It's going to feel uncomfortable at first, and
yeah.
to really embrace the discomfort of healing.
That's right. I mean, I'm in a relationship now that I believe is healthy, and it was uncomfortable at first because I wasn't used to this kind of person in my life, someone that was stable and available and kind and compassionate and supportive and all the things that we should be looking for in a healthy relationship. And it was a little bit uncomfortable, and then I allowed myself to just kind of be with it and deal with the discomfort and not run from it. And when I, allowed it to just morph into what it is today, it actually the love just grew and became bigger. Rather than that intense, oh my God, feeling that never really worked for me in my life, which to me I call love addiction.
Oh, I'm so happy for you, Sherry, and that really shows the authenticity of the work in healing you've done, that you are now actually realizing the fruits of a healthy, loving relationship.
I think so. I mean, I don't know what the future holds, but I know that it's possible, and that's the good news, that it can exist. And just really being, like you said, I want to be really transparent that people are not alone. It can happen to anybody, these things. And to really, forgive and have compassion for where you came from and where you're going and know that there's just always hope and healing, always.
Yes, yes. Such a great message. Such a great message, yes.
I sometimes end with positive affirmations. I don't know if that's your thing or not, Mike. Some people
absolutely.
A little woo-woo, but I can end the interview. So maybe I'll just say some couple of positive affirmations and you can repeat after me. The first one is, I am lovable and valuable. I am a lovable and valuable person.
I am a lovable and valuable person.
I am deserving of a healthy partner.
I am deserving of a healthy partner.
Who is capable of loving, respecting, and honoring me.
Who is capable of loving, respecting, and honoring me.
My needs and wants are important.
My needs and wants are important.
All my experiences contribute to my growth.
All my experiences contribute to my growth.
I walk away from toxic people.
I walk away from toxic people.
And finally, I create my own truth in love.
I create my own truth in love.
And by the way, I have an ebook and a love addiction quiz on my website. If people are curious, they can go to sherrygaeta.com. And I have a love addiction quiz, I have a codependency quiz, and then I have some free ebooks that go along with those quizzes.
Oh, that's great, great. So, yeah, people should go to sherrygaeta.com. To get those resources, and it sounds like would your Wake Up Recovery site, would that be a place where people with love addiction could go to begin a process of healing in an online community with you?
Yeah, it's all addiction, so yes, they can absolutely go to Wake Up Recovery if they're dealing with any kind of addiction. I'm sort of bringing together love addicts, codependents, and addicts, and kind of bridging the gap between all of these issues. I think sometimes we end up with not really understanding the other's point of view. So when you have an addict in a group and a codependent in a group, it kind of bringing them together. At least we call them double winners. There used to be, there's meetings called double winners for 12 steps. So that's kind of what Wake Up Recovery is, sort of bridging the gap for anybody that, is, and also people that want to learn more about the law of attraction. I'm a big believer in the law of attraction. That's not a real clinical term, but it is something that it's sort of similar to positive psychology. Putting the thoughts out there and taking the action steps to create the reality that you want to live in.
So if you, what you're saying is that if you visualize your ideal life and live out your affirmations, that the universe, according to the law of attraction, will in a way generously resonate with what you're putting out. And
even the 12 steps is a law of attraction for me, because you have like-minded people putting out, resonating positive energy towards their recovery. And, if they have a good program, they often stay sober. So, yes, I believe that the group work, the Wake Up Recovery, is all an example of the universe, having your back. When you're willing
absolutely.
To have
the universe is rigged in our favor, as the Sufi poet Rumi would say. Well, yeah. Sherry, this has been just great to have you on our show. Thank you so much.
You're welcome, Mike. Thank you for having me.
It's been great having you. And for listeners, visit SherryGaba, GABA.com, to learn more about her. And this has been the Well Mind with Dr. Mike show with Dr. Michael McGee here. And hope everybody benefited from this. And thank you for listening.